And welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. 2:09 is the time, and what a show we have for you today. Gordon Fricke is back to answer your automotive questions. Gordon Fricke is the owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive Incorporated, an independent repair, auto body towing, and used car facility in Hoosick Falls, New York. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/voxpop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC radio, or you can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can even email voxpop@wamc.org. Love your calls, though. 800-348-2551 is the number. And Gordon Fricke, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So often on this program, very often, we talk about how many miles should I go before an oil change.
Yes.
And you have found some interesting things.
Well, I was talking to a representative from one of the really large engine remanufacturers in the country.
Yeah.
So these guys have a lot of up-to-date information, and they're seeing failed engines, why they fail, what goes wrong, how to rebuild them, and how to do a better job in some cases to improve the engine itself.
Okay.
And what he said to me is, he said, are you getting a lot of people complaining about oil consumption?
You mean cars that burn oil?
Yes, using oil. And I said, you know, it's funny you say that, because it seems like the last few years we are getting people saying, I've never had to put oil in a car before between changes, and now I'm putting oil in this car every maybe 1,500 miles, maybe every 1,000, every 1,200. What's wrong with it? Well, right away you're saying, you know, cars don't do this anymore to speak of. Is it a venting problem? Is it leaking and they don't see it? Well, what the engine rep said is the car manufacturers have decreased the pressure on the piston rings, which are inside the cylinders that go around the pistons.
Why would they do that?
They did that so the engine would operate with less resistance, giving it a little more power and allowing the car makers to get a little bit better fuel economy.
Ah.
So across the board, they can get their fleet fuel economy numbers up. The engine doesn't have as much internal resistance, but the downside of it is those rings are allowing oil to get by and burning where we didn't have that happening. Not that many years ago, 5, 10, 15 years ago, you didn't have that happen.
I would be surprised that that isn't affecting the pollution requirements.
Well, you know, that's a good thing, but I believe that what's happening is the amount that's being burned over those 1,000 miles, 1,500 miles, is so minute and so gradual that it goes into the exhaust stream and the catalytic converter gobbles it up and cleans it, and it's not an issue.
Uh-huh.
But people should be checking their oil again like they used to. And I've had people with low oil warning lights come on saying, there's something wrong with my car. And it seems to be becoming normal.
Wow. Now, does that mean that these rings will have a lower shelf life?
I don't think the lifespan is going to be, if anything, it might be a little longer because they're not being forced into the cylinders as hard. But that brings us up to the synthetic oils, which are very common now. And the early use of synthetic oil, the car makers would say, do not put it in a brand new engine until it is fully broken in, or the rings may never properly seat because the synthetic oil is too slippery.
Aha. So now what happens?
Well,
go back to the old style oil?
No. You're going to have oil consumption issues.
Can you consume the synthetic oil without a problem?
Yeah, it burns it up. Goes out the tailpipe.
All right, let's go right to the phones. And Lisa in Montgomery. Lisa, you're on first.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question regarding probably a 10-year-old car. It's a Mazda 2003 MPV minivan. And I have about 110,000 miles on it. I put on about every year about 5,000 miles a year. So it's basically a car to get me, you know, just around town, not too far, not far distances do I use it for. I have the issue of, well, my mechanic, he suggested that I get rid of it because it has a catalytic converter issue, and he claims that, you know, you're looking at a couple of thousand dollars to repair it. So basically the check engine light goes on for, you know, probably about a couple of thousand miles, and then it will turn off, and sometimes it smells a little fumey. So I'm debating if I should listen to him, which I really don't want to do. I'd like to keep the car another few more years, but I don't know if you would think, in your opinion, if it's worth, you know, putting the money into a car that's 10 years old and has 110,000 miles. And that's pretty much, you know, has a couple of other things, but that's the one big issue. The car basically runs well, starts up, never stalls. So I'm just interested in what your take would be on that.
Has this prevented you from getting your car inspected? Yeah.
Well, it hasn't, because it shuts off, but right now the check engine light is on, and it's due for an inspection in January. So,
If it's showing the code for an inefficient catalytic converter, which sounds like what you have, that's generally a PO420. Because that light is sometimes on, sometimes off, and now it's on more often, that's because that catalytic converter has pretty much used up the material that keeps the exhaust clean, and the sensors in place are signaling the computer that it's not doing a very good job anymore. And when it's not cleaning up the air properly, it turns on the check engine light. So to answer your question, there are aftermarket catalytic converters available that are generally less costly than ones from the manufacturer, Mazda in your case. And I would certainly look into the option of putting one of those on the car. The warranty on the aftermarket replacements has been increased by the government to 5 years, I believe 50,000 miles. If the car is good enough for you where you think it's worth putting that kind of money into, I think you probably should, because think of what it's going to cost you to get another car.
Yeah, that was my position, is I don't, you know, really use it for work or anything. It's just, you know, get to the store, pick my daughter up, you know, and it's a good car, and it's a minivan, and I use it for recreational purposes also. You know, I throw my bike in the back, and to invest in a new car, it just seems kind of costly. What do you think that would run me? Would it be under 2,000?
I don't know, but I have a feeling it would be. 2,000 sounds like a pretty hefty estimate. Now, that's not unheard of by using factory original parts, but I would investigate using good quality aftermarket parts and see where you come up with. Get an estimate for that, and that'll help you decide what to do with the car.
Is labor a trouble with that job?
Generally not. Some catalytic converters are now part of the exhaust manifold. That becomes a labor issue, but when they bolt in after the manifolds, it's usually not a horrible job.
Okay.
So just you know, so if I went to a mechanic and I said I want an aftermarket part,
yes,
I guess obviously they would understand what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah, it's extremely popular and common in the industry.
All right, Lisa,
thank you so much. Bye bye.
Now, have I heard correctly that there platinum is a component of catalytic converters?
There is platinum in there. There's a metal called palladium. And I think rhodium is in there, maybe a few other choice ones, but those are called precious metals.
Yeah.
And they create a chemical change in the exhaust gases when they pass over it, and it changes it from harmful pollutants to much less pollutants.
Okay.
Some still comes out, but it's way cleaner.
Now, at some point then, you have depleted those precious metals?
Exactly. You use them up, and they stop cleaning the air, and it turns on the check engine light.
Wow. Let's go to Diane in New Salem. Hi, Diane. Great question.
Hello.
Here. I see it on the list, and I've wanted to know the same thing. I'll let you ask it.
What's that?
The question about the windshield wipers. Don't give it away. You go ahead.
Okay. Well, happy holidays, gentlemen.
To you, too.
Thank you.
This is short and snowy question. I lift my windshield wipers. I pull them away from the windshield when there's a storm coming. It makes it easier to clean the windshield.
Yeah, you see that a lot.
I see it in the parking lot all the time and say, well, what's the value?
Just the other day, there were lots of them.
Yeah.
And it's a good idea because when I have to plow my parking lot and move a whole bunch of cars and the wipers have frozen to the windshield.
Exactly.
That's bad news because, number one, if you turn them on by mistake, frozen, you can burn out the windshield wiper motor or break the linkage or cost yourself some money.
Okay.
And if you go to tear those wipers off of the frozen windshield, if they aren't in excellent condition, you might leave some of the wiper blade on the windshield. Now you need new wipers.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good idea.
Okay. I just wanted to know if it was harmful to the wiper mechanism.
No. You can fold them right up, and they're fine like that.
Oh, that's so good to know. Thank you so much.
That was a great question. Thank you, Diane.
Hey, Ray, you made my day yesterday on Pet Talk.
Oh, really? Well, I hope you enjoyed it.
Well, when you asked if maybe the dog changed her mind.
Oh, you caught that, did you?
Oh, I caught that, and I laughed about 10 minutes.
I was being naughty. All right, Diane.
You are naughty and funny. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Happy holidays to you. Let's take a break, Zach. Oh, boy, I didn't think anyone caught that. All right, we'll be back with Gordon Fricke and more of your calls at 800-348-2551 coming up.
Support comes from the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting the exhibition Dinotopia, The Fantastical Art of James Gurney, arkellmuseum.org. Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, offering organic and local groceries for the holidays and working to help build a healthy and sustainable community through cooperative engagement, berkshire.coop. Performance Automotive, Pittsfield, a European and Saab service center serving Western Massachusetts and the Greater Albany market for 25 years. Saab, it's not just a car, it's a passion. SaabPerformance.com. And ophthalmic consultants of the Capital Region, including ophthalmologist Dr. Alan Zeeker, performing refractive cataract surgery with new technology lens implants and astigmatism reduction. ophthalmicconsultants.com.
Hear that guy? That's John Harrington. That's Steely Dan, lead guitar player, and he put out his own record. He's done several records. We put one out last year and was at our Linda Norris Auditorium last fall, and what a great show it was. If you've never been to the Linda, I encourage you to check it out. There is a great variety of stuff to see there, thelinda.org. Let's go back to the phones. We're with Gordon Fricke today. Mark in Hillsdale. Mark, you're on.
Yeah, good afternoon, guys. I'd first like to say hello to my dad, Dave Bolivice, longtime listener and a pledge volunteer.
Well, all right, a shout-out.
Yeah, he just got a brand new Prius, and he's probably out putzing around with the intake system in the backyard right now.
Okay.
I have a 1990 Volvo 240 DL wagon with just shy of 75,000 miles, and I had a couple questions about the front end and whether or not a aftermarket cold air intake would benefit my mileage.
Okay. Question is first? Do you want to talk about the cold air?
Yeah. Aftermarket cold air intake, that would be much better than the stock one that's already on there.
First of all, how'd you ever find a 240 with such low mileage? Everybody put 500,000 miles on those cars by now.
Oh, I know. We grew up having them, and it was just kind of a go-for-the-moment kind of find. So no fingerprints on the glass on the inside, and all the numbers lined up. So
that's good. I don't know if you're going to benefit much from that cold air intake, to be honest with you.
Okay.
What it does in extreme cold weather may be a little bit counterproductive. It may be too cold because cars of that vintage had a big tube that came off of like a stove on the exhaust manifold, so you wouldn't get too cold air going through the intake. You see those systems, and they're on a lot of tuner cars and various vehicles. Do they help? Yeah, slightly. Would you notice a difference? Probably not. I don't think it would pay what it would cost to get one of those kits. My advice always is to keep a very good, clean air filter in the airbox. And there are some washable kinds that are... you buy them once and they last a million miles, and you clean them and spray them with some oil. I don't want to name the product because I'm not endorsing them, but those work very well. I use them, and they let the engine breathe as free as it can without going crazy and making modifications. So that's what I would do.
Okay.
All right. Oh, great. And in terms of the front end, my dad and I replaced the tie rod. Sorry, not the tie rods, the lower ball joints. Tie rod seemed good. All the struts and the shock tie, everything on the shock seemed pretty good. But there's a bit of a chatter when I go over like small bumps, and it doesn't change the direction of the car. It doesn't change under braking or acceleration or turning.
But it's a noise. Do you hear like a rattling?
Yeah, it's a bit of a rattle. I was thinking maybe the bearings is kind of like a, you know, when you just going over potholes or anything like that. It seems to last a little bit longer than after you've actually passed the bump or the pothole.
Yep.
And you can feel a little feedback to the steering column and to the steering wheel.
You know, it's been a long time since I've had 240s in, but I think they have front sway bars. And that sway bar is going to be connected up to the suspension somehow, maybe a stabilizer link. Those are high wear and tear items on all cars today, including current Volvos. We do a lot of those. I would be suspicious of sway bar bushings or sway bar links. And then the upper strut mounting plates have bearings in them. They're very hard sometimes to determine whether they're causing trouble or not, but I would look in there as well. And just the overall condition, the front of which you guys have kind of looked at already.
All right.
Well, that's what I would do.
Mark, thanks.
All right, thanks. I appreciate it.
Appreciate your call. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. It's automotive questions and hopefully answers. Ross in Waterford. Ross.
Hello there, gentlemen.
Hello.
My daughter was involved. She got a 2001 Ford Taurus, and some guy hit her from behind the other night, and it wasn't a major accident. But what happened was she called me. Her car wouldn't start after he hit her, and I went up and looked at it, and it just seems like it's starting for fuel. It kept trying to turn over, and somebody told me that Ford started putting an impact relay in the trunk of these cars after they had so much problems with cars getting hit from behind. And I wanted to know if you know whether that's true or not.
Yeah. Ford was one of the biggest companies to install these, and what it is they call it an inertia fuel cutoff switch, and it's just that. In the event of a crash or an impact, it takes the power away from the fuel pump, so the fuel pump cannot run, and that's to prevent the pump from, let's say the car caught fire and the fuel pump and the engine kept running for even 10-15 seconds, it would pour tons of gas on the fire.
Yeah,
that's exactly why they did that. That car definitely has one. And if you open the trunk, you will see a little, there's either a little flag or even a little decal that tells you that it's a fuel shutoff switch, and you can just push the button and reset it yourself.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
If the car has an owner's manual, it'll tell you exactly where it is and how to do it, but I can almost guarantee you without hesitation that's what happened to it.
Okay.
If you couldn't find it, could you pull the fuse and just put it back in?
No, because this is a mechanical disconnect.
Oh, okay.
It's an electrical disconnect, but it's mechanically done. So you have to physically reset it. It's like a breaker. Like when your breaker blows in the basement, you have to go down there and physically switch it back on.
I'll be darned. Okay.
So that's what it is.
Ross, thanks a lot for the call.
Much.
Yeah, we appreciate it. It's Jeff in Lexington. Jeff, you're on.
Yeah, I'm calling my Chevy Malibu 2009. I was just driving down the road with the other day on the interstate. Had the cruise control set about 70, and cruise control popped off, and low power warning light came on, and it said ESC, which is electronic stability control, and a few other lights came on. Managed to baby it to a rest stop, turned it off, thought maybe it had some water in the fuel, but dry gas in it, and it started back up and ran fine.
Were you driving in heavy slush, and was it during any of the storms we've had lately?
No, it was before that I had been, but then right after that it wasn't. The roads were all pretty much clear.
Yep. Now, you said the traction control and anti-lock lights came on?
Yep.
As well as the check engine light?
Yep.
Okay. Check engine light's still on?
That's correct.
Okay. What I would do is this, because your two systems got involved in this. The ABS, which is the traction control, and ABS work together, but in opposite. But your reduced power came on for some reason. What I would do is get that get the check engine light scanned for a code, because that's okay. That's the trace, or that's the evidence of what went wrong, or an area of what went wrong when that happened. And that okay. That will answer the question of why all these other warning lights came on. The fact that you're running fine now is that whatever caused it is now over. But it'd be nice to know what it was, because you may be able to prevent it from happening again. But
yeah.
I can't tell you what it is, because there's way too many possibilities with those warning okay. lights on. But I would get it scanned, and that'll help you determine where the problem was.
Also, I had one more quick question for you.
Okay.
The car, the very next day, my wife took it to work with her, and she said it started to smell like it was overheating. And I actually checked the oil when she got home the next day, and the coolant is low, and there may be coolant in the oil.
I doubt there's coolant in the oil. It's possible, but if you take the oil cap off in this weather, you will see some foam under the cap. Is that what you saw?
No, I saw it was like orange deposits around the top part of the dipstick.
I think I would be wanting to get that looked at more carefully, just in case there isn't something like that happening. Because did your low coolant warning light come on also?
No.
No, okay. I think you better get it checked, just in case there isn't something worse okay. ready to happen.
Okay.
Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate the call. You know, I've had the ABS and traction light go on after driving in very wet weather.
Yes.
And it just goes away. I figured the sensor got wet.
Sometimes it's because of all the slop that got on the sensors that interrupted the signal momentarily.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's salt in this grime that's on the roads right now.
And the traction, you know, I rarely think about it. You can turn it off. I think there's a button in the glove box.
Some cars you can.
But it comes in fairly handy.
It does work.
Yeah. Let's go to Larry in Kingston. Larry.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Two different Subarus I had. The first one was a smaller Impreza, probably a 99. And then later on my current car, 2006 Impreza Legacy. And during the winter on the first car, I got out, I warmed up my car, I came back out to get in it, and I noticed there was a horizontal crack in my windshield going almost the entire length of the dashboard. I had it repaired. It was kind of just inexplicable how it happened. I couldn't really figure it out, but the insurance covered it. I had it repaired. A few years later, my newer car, in the dead of winter, same exact thing happened. Same kind of brake going across the whole length. And it happened both times I don't know if it was from extreme cold or what. The only thing I could hypothesize was that maybe my defrost was on, and maybe it had heated the glass too quick and it had cracked. But I was just wondering what might have caused that.
Yeah. A lot of times you'll get a stone hit, and it won't do anything at that moment, but it'll put a stress on the windshield. And a lot of times a stone hit will spread and turn into a crack, and it'll get longer and longer and longer the more you drive the car. It's possible that you had a little stone hit that you didn't really know about, and it got so cold that when you started the car up with the defrost on, getting the windshield warmed up on the inside accelerated that crack. And a lot of the Subarus also have heating elements on the front windshield, but they're down low around the wipers to keep the wipers from freezing to the window.
That's where it happens.
Oh, down low?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have a feeling that it was because of the heating element in there, and that's what it's there for, though. It's to help defrost the windshield and get your wipers from unfrozen. But I'm just wondering if there was a little stress there to begin with, and this just exaggerated it. If this was the same thing happening on the same exact car twice, I'd be a little bit more concerned that there's an issue maybe with the windshield frame or how the windshield's held in the car. But since this is a totally different car, you're going to get this one replaced?
Yeah, well, I already had it done.
Yeah, okay, Did you mention that to the guy doing it?
I'm sorry, it was different. Actually, I brought it to two different places both times.
Yeah.
But I was just, I wasn't sure if it was a common thing with Subaru.
No, I don't see that as being an inherent problem with that car by any means.
Could it have been a neighbor that doesn't like you very much?
Oh, Ray.
No?
No, it was two different places I was living as well.
Ah. Well, maybe you're just that kind of guy. You know.
Pulled out, yeah.
All right. Well, Larry, thanks a lot. Good luck, all right?
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's go over to Jeff in South Glens Falls. Jeff.
Hi, Gordon. The check engine light started coming out of my car about a year and a half ago. The error code showed that it was oxygen sensors. Replace the oxygen sensors, or one of the oxygen sensors, and after just a few weeks, they got the same error codes again. So went back in and replaced both oxygen sensors. And did not use original equipment, used name brand aftermarket like Bosch. And it lasted a few months, and then the check engine light started coming on again. Well, I'm coming around to inspection time, so I've got to do something about the check engine light.
Sure.
The dealer tells me that the only oxygen sensors that will work properly are original equipment, that aftermarket will not work properly. Does that make any sense?
It depends on the vehicle. What's the year, make, and model of your vehicle?
2004 Suzuki Verona.
Okay. I have run into that situation with some vehicles where, and you have to be sure that the code is not just a area that the oxygen sensor is involved, that it's really a sensor failure, because you can have check engine lights come on and be fooled into thinking it's a sensor problem when it's something else. It's either running too lean. There's other issues that is maxing the sensor out one way or the other. All the computer will say is, for example, bank one too lean. And that's because the oxygen sensor said, wow, this has been too lean for too long. But there could be a reason why the sensor's being maxed out. So in the case of that Suzuki, I don't know if those vehicles are sensitive to getting the original equipment sensor. Some definitely are, have experienced it. So I would make sure that the diagnosis is as accurate as it can be, and I think I would investigate using the original equipment sensors if the dealer really is adamant about it. And it could be true.
All right, well, your answer kind of led me to another question then, because lately I sometimes get the error code for the sensors, and I sometimes get an error code for too lean.
Yeah, yeah. I have a feeling that you've got a lean condition occurring.
Okay, now, quickly, what is it? Not enough oxygen is too lean?
Too lean means that you're not getting enough fuel to the air ratio. There's either too much air or too little fuel, however you want to put it.
Okay, so what could that be?
You could have a vacuum leak, an intake vacuum leak somewhere. Could be a rubber line or a hose. It could be a gasket. It could be air leaking somewhere. And
what about mass airflow sensor?
Possible. It could be the mass air could be making the engine run too lean.
Okay.
A lot of times you will get a mass airflow code, but other times you won't. But somebody needs to get in there and look at the data and watch that airflow sensor, because that's pretty easy to test.
All right. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Gordon Fricke is here, Ray Graff as well. Gail and Adams, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
My question involves the starting up the car in extremely cold weather. I know that if you move too fast without letting the car warm up properly in extremely cold weather, you can blow some of your hoses. Like, you know, your steering hoses or whatever. I know that's not true in summertime. So my question is, first of all, is that true? And secondly, what's the temperature that's the critical temperature for driving your car without letting it warm up?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because a lot of the car manufacturers do not recommend starting the car and letting it run for a long time. And what that means is a half hour, 20 minutes, maybe even 5 minutes.
And why? What will happen?
Well, Gail is correct in the sense that if you have any weak links in your, let's say, your power steering system, in your hoses or your lines, even the pump, the seals, everything. When you start that car up at 10, 15 below zero.
Yeah, hang on just a sec. Gail, can you turn your radio down just a little bit?
Yeah, I asked the lady if she could hear it, and she said she couldn't.
Oh.
So I'm going to...
That would be great.
I'm going to go over and I'm going to turn the radio
off. All right, that would be great. In the meantime,
I can keep answering the question.
See, we're hearing ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very, very odd. It's
yeah.
One of those Bob Berman segments where he talks about the meaning of the universe, and I have no idea what's going on. All right, go back to your answer.
Yeah, so that power steering fluid, for example, is very thick and very hard to move at 10 below zero.
Yeah.
But at 10 below zero.
Yeah, well, I'm just using that as an example because we had 10 below the other morning.
All right.
And I had a vehicle come in that blew a return line off of the power steering.
From warming it up too much?
No, just it was a weak link, but it was so cold and the fluid was so stiff that it found the easiest place to go and it popped that line off.
Yeah.
I think this car has other issues because it has a lot of miles on it.
But why wouldn't you be able to warm your car up for 15 minutes? Not that I ever do, but...
Well, they say if you let it run too long, you are potentially getting some deposits in the oil from the extreme running without driving anywhere.
See.
But, you know, cars today are much cleaner and much more efficient.
Yeah.
And I like to warm my mechanical stuff up before I go out and drive it. The transmission, all that stuff should run for a few minutes to as much as maybe 5 or 10.
Yeah.
And then
it just have to move the dial to the minimum mark?
On the
temperature?
Yeah, the temperature dial on the car,
yeah.
Usually when I start out in really cold weather, is below the minimum mark.
Yeah,
and as it warms up, it'll get to the minimum mark and then, of course, go about halfway
yeah.
through the range.
If you're looking for a safe point where you can start to drive away, you want to see the temperature gauge begin to move on its own. So
okay.
you're correct. Get it above the lowest reading.
Okay.
And then drive easily until you're at full operating temperature.
Right.
Gail, thanks. We're going to take a break here, but thank you very much for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It is Gordon Fricke Day, and we hit the lightning round coming up.
Support comes from Edward Garbosik, Certified Financial Planner, Havokin Wealth Strategies, Wilbraham, Massachusetts. Providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement. HavokinWealthStrategies.com. Snow Farm, Williamsburg, Massachusetts. A New England craft program offering workshops for adults and teens taught by master craftspeople on a 50-acre farm. SnowFarm.org. Smith College Museum of Art, presenting River of Gold, pre-Columbian treasures from Sitio Conti, gold work from an ancient American society in central Panama. smith.edu/artmuseum for info. And Dr. Arthur Falk, Albany and Saratoga Springs, facial plastic surgeon and laser specialist, focusing on minimally invasive procedures for skin health and facial rejuvenation. AboutFaceDOC.com.
Fox Pop on WAMC. The number to call, 800-348-2551. Ray Graff here. Our guest is Gordon Fricke, and we go back to the phones. Bob in Albany. Bob, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I got a question about shock absorbers. I bought about a 10-year-old Ford Econoline, a 250. It's one of the camper conversions. It's got a sink in it, a refrigerator, and a bed, and so forth. And it's in great shape. It's got 70,000 miles, but there is not any rust on it, no damage. Prior owner took real good care of it. But, you know, on the steering and when I go over any kind of a bump, people in the back, like, they hit the ceiling, you know, they go, wooey, you know. And when I'm out there, I hit something on the highway at 60 miles an hour or so, I kind of feel I don't have control for a moment or two. So I'm wondering, is that just the nature of the van beast, or the shock absorbers really wear out, and should I really replace them? And if so, like, what do you recommend for frequency or heavy duty versus not, and so forth?
Sure, sure. What year is this van again?
It's about an 03.
Okay, yep. And the miles were about 70,000?
Yes.
Okay. because that those conversion vans are a bit heavier than just a empty cargo van or even a passenger van, they are kind of like driving the Titanic a little bit. They're a little bit wobbly and a little tipsy, and they're nice, comfortable vehicles. But to answer your question, at the age and mileage that you're indicating, it's very likely that those shock absorbers are not what they used to be. They may not be leaking, they may not be rusted to death, but there's valving inside there and passages that do get beat up and get softer and squishier. It would not be unheard of for that van to need a set of shocks. And they actually, some of the big shock companies make what they call RV shocks, like truck and RV. And definitely put that quality on there. Don't put the least expensive shock they make for just a standard Ford E250.
Okay.
You want to get the heavier shock because it's a heavy vehicle.
Will that make the ride more stiff if you have those grade shocks?
Yes, but it's not going to make it stiff and uncomfortable. It's going to make it feel like you're semi back in control.
Okay.
So I would definitely consider doing that.
And I assume for something like that, a regular good garage will do just as good
Absolutely.
Of a job as the dealership.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, you'll have better, more choices on what shocks to pick in the aftermarket because it's a big business.
Uh-huh.
So, okay. Yeah, you can talk to your guy about how good and stiff and quality of a shock
and how much
you want
to spend.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
Well, thanks very much.
Bob, thank you very much. It's Vox Pop on WAMC and Kyle in Rochester. Kyle.
Hi, I have a 2008 Ford Fusion with about 185,000 miles on it. About every 50 miles or so, I'm getting a hiccup in the power as I drive down the expressway. I don't have any idea what that could be. It's not my RPM gauge doesn't change that happens. Any idea what that could be?
But you feel it in the vehicle. The whole thing gives you like a little kick. Is it like somebody kind of kicked you in the bumper for a second?
Yep.
If you are under light acceleration and you're going up a mild incline, does that get more frequent, that little hiccup? Does it, you know, will it get steady?
It happens so infrequently that I can't really place exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be very difficult to diagnose.
Yeah, those problems most definitely are. The check engine...
There's no check engine light, and if it seems as though if I add the fuel injector cleaner to the gas tank, that somewhat resolves it.
Yep. Well, you got a lot of miles on that car for the age, so it could be a lot of things, but fuel deposits are definitely something to be concerned with, and if you use a very good quality fuel injection cleaner, something that has Tecron in it, which is the chemical, it certainly would not hurt to give it a good dose or two of that. It could be the beginning of a misfire in terms of maybe an ignition coil. How old are the spark plugs and all that kind of maintenance stuff? Do you know?
The spark plugs I haven't changed. I put about 100,000 miles on the car last year.
How many miles are on the car total?
185.
And you've never put spark plugs in it? Did you buy the car new?
No, I bought the car used.
Okay, and how many miles were on it when you bought it?
About 60,000, I believe.
Okay. I think you need spark plugs regardless of whether it takes care of this kick or not, because those old spark plugs with their wide burned-out gaps are causing a lot of strain to your ignition system, and they're going to bring about failed ignition coils if you keep driving it that way. I think what I would do is get the maintenance up to date, spark plugs, filters, and get some fuel injection cleaner in there, and then see what happens. You may find that it's mysteriously gone.
Hey, that's good news. Hey, Kyle, are you really in Rochester right now?
Right now I'm in, where the heck am I? About Herkimer.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, it would be a heck of a shot for our radio station to make it to Rochester. Hey, Kyle, drive safely. Thanks a lot. We appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Bye now. Marty in Pittsfield is up. Marty, you're on Vox Pop.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good.
Hey, I've got a 94 Dodge Grand Caravan all-wheel drive. It's quite a beast in the snow. Anyway, I was trying to put a new plate light in it when the plate lights was out. And I put it in, nothing worked. And now none of the the lights on the outside of the vehicle work except the headlights.
Marty, probably what you did mistakenly is when you changed that bulb, you must have did you change the bulb when the lights were turned on?
Yes.
Yeah, you must have mistakenly shorted something out and blown the fuse. Because
I've checked all the fuses, all the relays. I got the front headlights working, but nothing. The hazards work, the turn signals work, everything
yep.
else. Kind of weird.
Yeah, all those marker lights and the plate lights, they're all usually on the same circuit.
Yeah.
When you said you checked the fuse, did you put a test light across it to make sure it had power on both ends of it? Or did you just look at the fuse to see if the element was still good?
I pulled them out to see if they're good, yes.
Yeah. What you need to do is, was there one fuse that identified those lights?
It seems like there's one in the front. There's a big 40 amp in the front.
Yeah, that's not the one. You're going to have a much smaller amperage fuse, and I think there's a second fuse box in that vehicle, not the big one under the hood. I think there's one inside somewhere.
There's one under the driver's side.
Yeah. Go get your owner's manual and go to the fuse that runs either your running lights, or they may call them parking lights, or it may be abbreviated. But
yeah.
You need to check to see if there's power going in and out of that fuse, because I'm sure that something happened to that circuit. That's what runs all those lights.
Yeah, I know. I pulled out the pigtail for the plate light button. That was good, so
yep.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Luckily, I've got a 97 Benz sitting in my garage ready to go, so all is not lost.
Might as well break it out.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Gordon Fricke is our guest, and our producer, Jessica Blaustein. Marshall hands this to me. I'll put my glasses on because, old age creeps up fairly quickly.
You just have cheaters, right, Ray?
Yeah, these are just readers. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so this is from our website, a comment posted on our Vox Pop page. Mike asks, you said you warm up your car for 5 minutes and mentioned warming up the transmission. How does the transmission warm up if the car is not moving and sitting in park or neutral?
That's a nice question.
Yeah.
Because when the engine is running, even if you're in park or neutral, the torque converter of the transmission is turning and the front pump is turning and fluid is flowing through the transmission.
Uh-huh.
Even though it's not engaged in moving the car, there are things going on inside that automatic when you're sitting there in neutral or park. And there's also an oil cooler that keeps the transmission fluid at the right temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And that does a added bonus in cold weather, because that cooler also is a warmer.
Oh.
And that transmission fluid flows up to the radiator, goes through its own little teeny heat exchanger so as not to make contact with the coolant.
Yep.
comes back to the transmission warmer than when it went in. So you're warming up the automatic transmission like that in cold weather.
Brilliant.
Good
All
question.
Right. Let's go to Carolyn in Poughkeepsie. You're on, Carolyn.
Well, gee whiz, thank you. Okay.
You're on.
Okay, I have a 2007 Subaru Forester, which I love, and the oil light has never come on since we bought the car. Now, we had trouble with bucking, and so we had the struts changed because everyone said it was the struts. And then the bucking still stayed. Nothing helped the bucking too much. I'd say, it's still there, about the same. And let's see, the engine light and the cruise light are constantly on for the last year, on and off, sometimes blinking, sometimes staying. Just on. And I liked what you were talking about earlier about maybe it had something to do with the catalytical converter, because something to do with the cylinders that they were making, because the first we had a test of everything in the car, and it said that the 303 cylinder was the problem.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's the only problem. And we had the struts changed already, and we're about to get the 303 cylinder changed and taken care of. But I have 127,000 miles on the car, and I'd like to keep it longer if I can.
All right. Yeah, those are good, durable cars.
Yeah, I like them.
The check engine light needs to be, of course, diagnosed because there could be more than one code in there. But the 303 you're talking about is a cylinder misfire for cylinder number 3. Not uncommon, particularly on Subarus, among other cars. What year is the car again?
2007.
2007.
I'm sorry, 2006.
Yeah. Six, okay. Given that mileage, if you have not had any maintenance done or kept up with the spark plug changes and maybe ignition wires and things like that, get the car up to speed maintenance-wise, and, of course, to answer that cylinder number 3 misfire. And that's why the cruise control is on, because the cruise control is turned off because the check engine light is on. In terms of the catalytic converter, that's jumping too far ahead because that won't really create any running problems like you've described. But I think the balking could be your misfire, and it could be misinterpreted as maybe the car needed struts anyway, but I think you got a couple of different things going on.
Hey, Carol,
what is causing the misfire again?
Well, it could be a spark plug. It could be a spark plug wire, among other things. That needs to be diagnosed.
Okay, Carolyn, we're going to have to let you go. The connection, I must say, is very interesting. You're not contacting us via ham radio today, are you?
I have the radio on, and, I couldn't get it to shut it off, and I was listening to what he was saying, and I was realizing that at the same time,
well,
the phone call is going on.
Yeah, I think there may be something wrong with your phone. It sounds a bit like an early transatlantic connection, but thank you very much. Let's go over to Dave in Pine Plains. Dave.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have a 2005 Chrysler Pacifica with 96,000 miles on it. And I was told that at this time I would need a timing belt, tensioner, water pump, and idler. So I don't know. Is that true? I mean, is this the time for it? Or
you sure they weren't saying drive belt or serpentine belt?
Pardon?
Were they saying timing belt or a serpentine belt?
They said a timing belt.
I'm just trying to think on those Pacificas what they use. I didn't think they had a timing belt.
Thought it was an all-in-one?
Well, it might be a chain engine, but
no.
It could be a belt engine. I'm not sure what they had for engine options, but
yeah,
if it is a timing belt-driven engine, you're probably close to needing it done. Most manufacturers now are at 90, some are at 105,000,
right.
Some are at 110, but it's definitely, if you have a belt-driven engine, it most definitely needs to be done pretty much when recommended, both in terms of miles and time. Because if the belt breaks, it's usually bad news for the engine.
Yeah, that's what they were told. Well, what would consider to be a reasonable price?
The price really goes haywire depending on the vehicle, but we do a lot of these on different cars. We do Subarus, we do Audis, we do Volkswagens. It's not crazy to hit $1,000 on these things.
In other words, is it more of a labor issue depending on the vehicle itself?
Both, because you're buying a belt, the tensioner, some pulleys, you're buying a water pump, the serpentine belt on the outside, and a bunch of labor.
So it's a
big job, but it's extremely important.
Right. I was told this is from the dealer, $1,450 he quoted.
Well,
is that too much?
Well, he can't legally say whether it's too much or too little, but he can.
Yeah,
I understand. Oh, that's right. Okay.
I can't price quote, and I can't look up your vehicle, but I have had vehicles, high-end cars that topped that price because of the expense of the parts and the amount of labor involved.
Yeah.
So,
$1,000
to do that job complete is not unheard of. So, if the dealer's saying $14, the labor rate's going to be a little higher. You know, it may be pretty much in line.
All right, Dave, but we're out of time, but thank you very much for calling, and thanks to everybody who called in. Sorry if you didn't make it through. Support comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings, henyonbakery.com. Fleet Feet Sports, Colony and now Malta, New York, locally owned specialty-run shops featuring footwear, apparel, and training programs for all distances, all abilities, FleetFeetAlbany.com, the Legislative Gazette newspaper in print at LegislativeGazette.com, online for additional daily news and updates on New York State news, coverage on Albany's political community for over 32 years, and the Beechwood Group of Wells Fargo Advisors, LLC, serving not-for-profits and individual investors, Mary McDonald Financial Advisor and Joseph Steiniger, CFP Financial Advisor, TheBeechwoodGroup.com. Gordon Fricke, thanks for being here today, bud.
You're welcome.
We'll see you, I guess, in the new year. Thank you for joining us today on Vox Pop. Our engineer, Zach Malloy, phones answered by Colleen O'Connell. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Moyers & Company. Next week, it's Medical Monday, of course. Alan will be here. Orthopedist Dr. Russell Cecil will be here. And that's exciting. Have a great weekend. Stay tuned now for a news update.